Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold. If you are unfamiliar with my other podcast, I often cover stories from the television show Unsolved Mysteries. For the past 5 years, you've heard me talk about these cases on my own, but now's your chance to hear me have in-depth discussions about them with other people. I want to welcome you to my new project, The Path Went Chilly, where I will be discussing in-depth with my two good friends and co-hosts cases that I've covered on The Trail Went Cold. Meet my co-hosts. First one up is Jules.
Hi, I'm Jules from the podcast Riddle Me That True Crime, and I have a PhD in transpersonal counseling. I'm not a psychologist or a diagnostician, so don't get too excited. But I can't wait to analyze these cases with these two amazing humans. You've already met Robin, now meet Dr. Ashley Wellman.
Hi, I'm Ashley. I have a PhD in criminology, law, and society, and I specialize in trauma victims and survivors. I've spent a great deal of time working with families left behind after homicides with a cold case unit based out of Florida, and I'm also a professor of criminology. I'm so excited to be chatting with two of my best friends about the cases that everyone can't seem to get enough of.
We hope in doing so that we will have a clearer perspective of what may have transpired. Oftentimes, Ashley will be totally in the dark.
Jules and I will be telling Ashley a story she may not know much about, so all of her reactions are genuine.
We will be releasing on all major platforms April 8th.
We hope you will join us as we attempt to heat up some ice-cold cases.
The Path Went Chilly will be available every Thursday on all major podcast platforms.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are The Prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we continue our look at the trial of Temujin Kinsu and decide whether or not an innocent man is in prison. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my illustrious co-host, Alice.
Thank you, Brett. How's that spreadsheet going? Are you updating it?
It's going great. I am updating it. That one came from an internet user named ASDFJKLL. So shout out to that combination of consonants and one vowel for sharing a very appropriate descriptor for Alice. Alice is illustrious.
Maybe. More like illustrious as of a year ago when we started this podcast.
Do you feel like you've declined in luster over the last year?
Potentially. But we won't get into that. That's too much. Why give fodder to the haters?
Exactly. To the haters. Well, Alice, we're back with Temujin Kinsu again today. We spent a lot of time talking about this last week, and I think you're already starting to understand out there why this was an interesting case for us. Now, we really beat up on the prosecution, I think, last time. So this time, we are going to give you some more of the evidence that they put on that they thought helped to show that Temujin was, in fact, guilty of the murder of Scott Macklem. And the most critical testimony of all came from Scott's fiancée, Crystal Merrill.
Absolutely, Brett. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind, Brett already mentioned this, but I really want to emphasize. We often hear some comments, some, you know, messages from you all saying that was a slanted presentation because you didn't present all the evidence in favor of or against that defendant. And this is so important because listen to what Brett said. This testimony that I'm about to tell you about is exactly what the jurors heard. This is explosive testimony. This is not shaded. This is coming straight from the trial transcript. So keep that in mind. Put yourself in the jurors' shoes as I tell you what Crystal Merrill told the jurors. Crystal gets on the stand. And remember, once you take the stand, you have to take the oath that you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. You don't get to just tell part of the truth. So she is swearing to all of this as she's sitting on the stand. Now, Crystal says that she met Fred at a video store where she worked when he came in to rent a movie. Crystal described Temujin as a martial arts expert. Crystal claimed that the first time they had a date, Temujin raped her. When Temujin's lawyer objected to this testimony, and you can imagine why your lawyer would be jumping up objecting, the word rape comes with it so many emotions, and it's hard to come off of rape. If you're thinking someone's a rapist, it's hard to think that they're a good person otherwise, or may not have done something bad, in this case, murder.
I don't know that there's anything more, other than he killed somebody before, I don't know if there's anything more prejudicial.
I agree, especially in a juror's mind, in anyone's minds. But right now we're talking about the jurors because this is who is hearing the testimony. So if I were in the courtroom and I were Temujin's lawyer, of course I would jump up. Even if I didn't think I had a basis, I probably would jump up and object. But here I do think there's a basis to object. And the basis would be that exactly what Brett said. It's extremely prejudicial and not probative for the case that he's on trial for here. But in response to that objection, the judge said there was no basis for the objection, and he allowed the testimony to be let in and for Crystal to continue telling the jurors about this rape. And so what Crystal said was that following this rape, the two actually began to date. Crystal claimed that when Temujin found out about Scott, he called a member of something she described as a secret ninja group and told them to put a hit out on Scott. She said the group, the secret ninja group, was called Akusar, which was an organization that fought prostitution and drugs and everything. Now, let me just stop real quick in case some of you are thinking, what's Akusar? I'm not sure there was any testimony that actually backed up that this was in fact a secret ninja group, but this is what Crystal was claiming that Temujin called on. This group was, according to Crystal, opposed by another group that sold drugs and ran prostitution rings. So you can kind of see the forces of good and evil in her story. So Crystal claimed that Temujin carried poison darts on his wrists and in his shoes. Crystal said this about the organization, quote, "The only thing is if I ever got married, I couldn't tell my husband what I was into. And if I ever had children, I had to raise them according to what these ninja people believed. And if they ever told anybody, if my children ever told anybody about this ninja stuff, that the organization would have to kill them right away."
Now, this is like, I mean, wow, right? I mean, this is crazy. I mean, this is insane stuff.
It's so explosive. I mean, it's so explosive because she's saying something that truly can't be backed up because she ultimately didn't marry into it. She didn't have a kid within the organization. And so she's making these explosive claims that really can't be backed up.
And you may be wondering out there why she can testify about all this. Because this is just her saying what Temujin said. So, you know, you might be thinking, isn't that hearsay? Can she really just sit up there and say he said all these things and get away with that? And the fact is she can, because the statements of the person who's on trial are not hearsay. There's an exception to the hearsay rule. So anything that Temujin had said in the past, or anything that Crystal says Temujin said in the past, that can all come in and you can't keep it out.
Right. It's called statement of a party opponent. And Crystal, this is not all Crystal said. She goes on. I mean, you can imagine the jurors are just hanging on the edge of their seats. Their mouths are probably open and they're leaning in because this is such explosive testimony. Now, Crystal also testified that Temujin could read minds, but not hers, because she was able to block him. Temujin recognized much of what Crystal said as coming from a movie called Tough Turf that they had watched together. But Crystal denied seeing the movie. And that would make sense, actually. This sounds like it's from a movie. It sounds like some plot line of a secret ninja organization.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, and so in cross-examination, Temujin's lawyer brings it up, but she says, nope, never heard of that movie, never saw it.
It's really interesting because so much of the state's case turns on whether or not you believe Crystal. Now, she's talking about all the secret ninja stuff and secret ninja organizations, but she's not necessarily saying that she believes all that. She's saying this is what Temujin told her. Temujin believes it because he's crazy. And, you know, he's living in this fantasy world where there are secret ninja organizations battling each other over prostitution and drugs. And he's a part of the good group, but it's only kind of good because if anybody finds out about it, they get murdered. But he tells her all about this in their, you know, 5-week relationship or whatever. And it's just one of those things the prosecution is trying to do to show that Temujin is this unstable person. He's this unstable person who's prone to do rash things that might not necessarily make sense to the average person on the outside, but to him would make sense.
And you can imagine why the jurors want to believe this. There is some strain of fact that they can tie this to. Remember what Temujin's alibi is. He said that he was at the martial arts studio. You know, the martial arts studio is what the prosecution is spinning into the secret ninja society. So it's not completely out of nowhere. But as we said in the last episode, I think the prosecution is really preying on the unknown, the East Asian martial arts that at this time wasn't just readily available, you know, on the TV, on being able to buy nunchucks and ninja stars on Amazon. This was more of the unknown.
And it also fits in with the other sort of theme that the prosecution's been playing with since their opening statement, which is this idea of Temujin as this outsider, this, you know, weird, strange, different kind of guy. And Crystal is this innocent country, rural girl from their community. She doesn't know anything about this. So if he's telling her all these things, she probably does believe it. And it probably is effective as part of his effort to control her.
Right. And you know, the thing about this that is particularly effective for Crystal's testimony is, as I was telling you what she testified to, you know, Brett was saying, this is insane. This is so fantastic. It sounds like a movie. And in fact, I think that's what the defense is trying to say. This is actually a movie plot. But when Crystal's saying it, she's also probably showing, she's incredulous as well, saying, can you believe the crazy things that Temujin believes? This is what I was beholden to. And that's how crazy he is. He would even kill my fiance, the father of my child.
And when on cross-examination, when Temujin's lawyer is talking to her, he's saying things like, so you believed there was a secret organ, the secret ninja organization, and you believed he could read your minds, and you believed he was carrying poison darts with him everywhere. And she would say, that's just what he said. That's what he told me. That's what he was saying. One thing that's interesting, and we don't have the pretrial hearing, but there was a pretrial hearing. And in that hearing, she also testified. And one thing the defense attorney attempts to do during cross-examination is undermine her testimony to this jury by using statements that she had made in a prior hearing and sort of asking her, well, didn't you say at the preliminary hearing X, Y, and Z? And at the preliminary hearing, Crystal was much more, she believed all this, and she, and that Temujin could read minds, and you know, that he was this sort of secret ninja master. And it seems pretty clear that the prosecution had done a good job of working with her a little bit on her testimony to make it clear that she doesn't necessarily believe this stuff, but this is what Temujin wanted her to believe.
Right, and that's effective coaching because it further builds that narrative. Us, you know, good small-town folk against strange unknown murderers. Now, Crystal testified that Temujin broke up with her in June, and then after a couple weeks, she didn't hear from him again. Scott was killed in November. Crystal testified that Temujin and Scott had never spoken to each other and might have been in each other's presence only once, so they were not known to each other.
And the defense does a good job of bringing this out on cross-examination, but to me, this is one of the big holes in the prosecution's theory. So even if you think that Temujin is this sort of crazed ninja warrior guy and he's got something, there's just something wrong with him. Even if you believe that, the fact that he breaks up with her and everybody seems to agree that that's what happened, that he then moves away, that he has no contact with her essentially for months before the murder, doesn't speak to her again until after the murder, and we're supposed to believe that he nevertheless is super controlling stalker type who would kill Scott. And that just doesn't fit. If he's a super controlling stalker type, why did he move away? Why did he break up with her? How was he keeping tabs on her? You know, this is where Crystal's, you know, it seems like maybe she's buying into the fantasy more because she's talking about how, well, he knows all these people and he has these friends and the organization and all this other stuff. And that's how he would keep tabs on her. Well, I mean, the organization doesn't exist. You know, I mean, there is no organization. But I think, and we know that, and that's another sort of subtle thing, that prosecution never comes out and says there is a ninja organization. They never do that. But they allow the jury to consider the possibility. They don't debunk it either. So, you know, they're sort of playing both sides here.
Absolutely. Now, Crystal also gave some suspiciously convenient testimony about Temujin's car, stating, quote, he did say that the reason he couldn't take his car is because the license plate on his weren't good. Something about it didn't match up with his car. The license plate didn't match up with his car or something to that effect. He really didn't give me a whole thing on it. Now, this fit with the prosecution's theory that Temujin had used a fake license plate on the car he used to kill Scott, which is why the number recorded by the witness did not match the car or any car associated with Kensu. This is convenient because Crystal drops that in and then the prosecution can use that in their argument. She doesn't have to make the argument, but it's a great fact to be able to weave in for the prosecution to explain basically no ability to tie the car that was seen by a witness to Temujin.
Yeah, it's very convenient for them, very valuable for them, because it was a hole in their case. And it's something people point to this day. I know Maggie talked about it. The fact that you have this description of a vehicle that doesn't match his vehicle, and you have this license plate, which simply just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit with any car that he ever owned, and the theory of the prosecution was that he had stolen that license plate. It turned out, I think it returned to a dealership somewhere. So probably the witness just got the number wrong, but that's not good because you don't want the witness to get the number wrong, because the whole point is we're relying on the witness's memory and his attention to detail. And they tie this back to a dealership, but they can never find the license plate. So the theory is that he stole this license plate. So once again, he has to fly down, find a car, go steal a license plate, put the license plate on the car, go kill this person, drop off the car somewhere, get rid of the license plate, get back to the Upper Peninsula. And that's essentially the prosecution's theory. And having Crystal say this is very helpful for them because it says, look, this is a pattern. This is something he does. He's often using license plates that are not associated with him. Now, her testimony, I mean, Alice read it to you verbatim, is really weak. It's obvious. It really sounds like something she made up. This doesn't sound like an actual conversation she had with him. And if she did have a conversation with him about this, she clearly doesn't remember much of it. It's very vague, very general, and to me seems a little too convenient.
Right. And, you know, That's why cross-examination is so important, because a witness can be coached. They can, and you know, it's not bad to be coached. If you're going to put a witness on the stand, you always meet with them. You talk with them. You want to know what the flow is, how they're going to react to certain questions, so you can ask questions in a way that will elicit the best testimony for your side. So there's nothing wrong necessarily with meeting and prepping your witness. And that's a question that's often asked when a witness is on the stand. Have you met with, you know, the prosecutor? Yes. And you don't talk about what you said with them, but you can say that they have prepped you. But the reason cross-examination is so important is if a story is not real, it's really hard to answer follow-up questions. So you can rehearse a dramatic monologue, a dramatic soliloquy about this, you know, secret ninja organization with poison darts in your wrists and in your legs, and your baby is, you know, baptized into this ninja organization. But then when you are asked follow-up questions about it, it's all hollow underneath. It's just a veneer. The truth goes deep. And so in cross-examination, if it's true, there are follow-up questions that you can answer that can back up your story. And that's not really what happened here. Now, there's a little bit more. On direct, Crystal stated that she'd only ever shot a BB gun and acted as if she didn't even know what a shotgun was, describing it as a gun with a long barrel and a BB on top of it that acted as some sort of sight. But on cross, Crystal admitted that her family owned guns. They hunted pheasants, and that she had fired them for target practice at least twice. So this is what I mean by cross-examination kind of breaking down a rehearsed story and getting to the truth. Crystal claimed that she had lost her keys and they were found in Scott's car the day he was shot. So again, this is placing evidence where the prosecution needs it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot going on here. So you have two things. At one point, Crystal tries to say that Temujin had stolen her keys or wanted her keys and she wouldn't give him her keys. And then she lost her keys, and the implication is that he stole her keys, and then the keys, voila, are there in Scott's car. The other thing, there was no evidence that Temujin owned a shotgun. So this murder obviously wasn't committed with a katana or a sai or nunchucks. It was committed with a shotgun. The only person who could put Temujin with a shotgun was Crystal. Crystal testified that she had seen Temujin with a shotgun, but she testified to this from this point of view of total innocence, as if she really didn't know anything about guns. And all she knew about this gun that she had seen was that it had a long barrel and had a BB on top of it. And so then the prosecution, in sort of a, you remember the Michael Peterson case, they kept using that blowpoke that wasn't the blowpoke that would have killed Kathleen, but it was an example, and they were using it as an example to testify from. So the prosecution didn't have the murder weapon, but this allowed them to bring in a shotgun and say, did the gun look like this? And she says, yes, that's what it looked like. And so it almost is a stand-in for a shotgun. But here's the weird thing about Crystal's testimony. So she says she's never seen a gun like that before, but her family owned guns like that. They hunted pheasants. If you've ever shot pheasant, you know you use a shotgun to do it. You're not shooting pheasants with a rifle or a pistol or an AR. You're using a shotgun. She had fired that gun on multiple occasions, and we have her keys in Scott's car. Honestly, if anybody has sort of the means, possible motive, and opportunity to commit this crime, kind of seems like Crystal might. She has a shotgun. She's fired a shotgun. She's in a relationship with him. We don't know what the actual circumstances were with their relationship. She claims they were going to get married. Maybe they were. Her keys are in the car, the keys that she claims she had lost. The police should have at least looked into her. I don't know that they did. I don't know if they ever looked into her. And so she gives them this story of her crazed ninja ex-boyfriend, and they run with it. And Crystal is the first person who identified Fred Freeman, Temujin Kinsu, as a witness. When the police, the first thing they did is they went to her and they said, is there anybody you can think of who might would have done this? And she pointed to him. So she's the one who starts this for him and gets him involved. So to me, that's very interesting. And it's unfortunate that the police never really did a real investigation here. Most likely Crystal's completely innocent, didn't do anything, but it still would be nice to know where she was that morning and if there were any bad blood between the two of them.
Absolutely. When you say it like that, I mean, it sounds like she immediately seized on the, woe is me. Let's look elsewhere.
Right, right. Which is always suspicious, right? I mean, there's always at least some suspicion in that when she's the person who identifies him as a potential suspect. She puts the gun in his hands, essentially. She explains why the license plate wouldn't fit. She gives him a motive. It's all very convenient. It's all very convenient that she is the one who does all those things. But she was not the only witness for the prosecution. So you may not believe Crystal. You may think Crystal's testimony is kind of crazy or she's not believable. Well, the prosecution anticipated that, and they had some witnesses to back her up. And one of the most valuable witnesses they had was a man named Philip Joplin. Now, Joplin was what we often call a jailhouse informant, and he testified that at some point in time, he and Timogen were in a holding cell together. So some of you may know this, some of you may not. You get arrested, you're sort of brought into the police station. Usually, unless you know you're particularly dangerous, everybody's kind of held in a holding cell, and they're kind of waiting there for their to be processed, whatever it is, to go see a judge, to move to another facility, to get bailed out, whatever the situation is. In this case, Joplin said that he shared one of these holding cells with Timogen for a couple of hours. And during that time, he claimed that Timogen unburdened his soul to Joplin, admitting the murder. Joplin testified to this fact, and he did so in exchange for leniency from the prosecution. We're going to talk about that more in a second because this is actually an interesting thing. The problem is, and we can talk about the problems with jailhouse informants generally, he would later tell investigators that he fabricated this whole story using details supplied by the prosecution to him to bolster his credibility. Interestingly, at trial, he testified that he received no benefit from testifying, a statement that turned out to be a lie. In fact, the way it worked was the prosecution took him out of jail for this testimony, and the promise was he would not have to go back to jail, and he did not go back to jail. The prosecution worked with the probation office there to set him up in a halfway house. That was his reward for testifying. Now, he claimed he didn't testify, and to make matters even worse, and I don't know why the judge did this, but the judge spontaneously tells the jury at the conclusion of his testimony that Joplin had received no benefit for testifying and that he knew that because he had sentenced him on the sentence that he was serving. And so he's like, look, he didn't receive any benefit because I gave him the sentence I was going to give him.
Oh, that's completely improper.
Totally improper. It's completely improper for him to do that. Major bolstering of this witness. And the judge doesn't know that he's actually wrong, that he's not actually correct. But once he says that, the jury, of course, is going to believe Joplin, that he received no benefit. Joplin, only a few years later, would recant his testimony. And he did this after learning that he only had 6 months to live. And he told the investigators he spoke to that he wanted to clear his conscience before he died. This is interesting because typically we have evidence rules about what we call dying declarations. Now, this is not a dying declaration. The dying declarations tend to happen when you literally are on death's doorstep. So there's this belief that no one wants to go to heaven or, you know, face God with a lie on their lips is the idea. So if you think you're dying, you can actually recover and it's fine. If you believe you're dying and you say something, you say, John killed me or the car was red or whatever, the presumption is you wouldn't lie about that. And since you wouldn't lie about it, that's a statement that can come in despite the fact it might be hearsay. Otherwise, this is not exactly that, but it's a similar situation. You have somebody who's dying. They know they're dying. They have this thing that they want to explain. And so before he died, he gives this this declaration that I lied. I made it up. He didn't tell me anything. We spent 2 hours together. So...
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there, Brett. We mentioned that Joplin got leniency for this. Now, a benefit can come in many forms. It doesn't just have to be that you're not prosecuted for something or you get a break from your sentence, that you get less time for the sentence you're serving. Like we see here, it could be that he just doesn't go back to serving his sentence in jail, but he's still serving his time just in a halfway house, which is probably better for him, a better place for him. And so that is a benefit. There are lots of ways to get a benefit. It is not wrong. It is not against the rules for a witness to get leniency, to get something in exchange for testifying. So I don't want you guys to think that just because he got something for it, somehow it was wrong. There can be cooperation agreements between witnesses who are defendants in other cases themselves with prosecutors to incentivize them to testify, because you can imagine, if especially if they're going back on the streets or they're going back into a jail, testifying or being a snitch is a really terrible offense. They're putting themselves on the line for these sorts of things. And also, they don't have to say anything. This is not kind of their fight to fight. They can just stay quiet, not ruffle any feathers, not potentially get in trouble with secret ninja societies or, you know, mad family members or fellow gang members who want to avenge their friend who the witness is testifying against. So you can imagine that there is a risk to the witness testifying. So it is okay for them to get something in exchange. But if they get something in exchange, it's fine for the opposing counsel to ask them about it, and you have to be truthful. So that's one of the first things that you'll hear a government cooperator or a prosecution cooperator be asked by the defense counsel. You know, have you met with prosecutors? Are you getting something in exchange for your testimony today? Sometimes the answer is really no, but if there is something, they have to testify truthfully.
And usually it's actually one of the questions they get from the prosecutor as well. The prosecutor will often preview that, sort of try and take the sting out of the defense's attack on their credibility by saying to them, either at the beginning of their testimony or the conclusion of their testimony, now let's talk about you. Why are you in jail? Are you receiving any benefit from this? What were you told you have to do to get that benefit? And the answer should always be tell the truth. So that will come out. And the difference here is he essentially lied about it. And it seems like, and I hate to throw accusations at fellow prosecutors, it seems like the prosecutors kind of let that go. They knew that he was getting something. He said he wasn't getting anything, and they didn't correct the record.
And by the way, it's okay. Yeah, it's okay for the prosecutor to correct the record. Remember, oftentimes we'll ask questions of a witness and they get the answer wrong. Like, and I say wrong, not as in they're not telling me the answer I want to hear. It's just, I know it's false. You know, if you ask, are you working right now? And I know they have a job and they answer no. It's not always lying. Sometimes they get it wrong and sometimes they lie. You know what you're supposed to do as the attorney if you know the answer is wrong? You're supposed to clear the record. So you could say something like, now, are you sure about that, Mr. Joplin? Or what about with respect to where you'll be going next? You can lead them if it means you're getting them to the right answer. And in this case, it would be against your interest, right, as the prosecution. But you're supposed to do that because all attorneys, prosecutors and defense counsel, have taken an oath to have candor with the court. It's part of every ethics rules in just about every bar for every state. It's in the, you know, American Bar Association model rules, ethic rules, is candor, your duty of candor to the court.
And another thing to point out about this testimony, there's nothing wrong with preparing a witness to testify. So I watched part of this. This witness did an interview talking about this. And one of the things he said was, oh, yeah, you know, they told me when you answer the question, when you say that he told you he killed this guy, make sure you look at the jury and lock eyes with them, because that'll make them really believe you. There's nothing wrong with talking to a witness about how they should testify, things like that, being clear, being direct, speaking to the jury. There's no problem with that at all. The problem comes when you are giving them the content of their testimony. If it is true that the prosecution gave him details to make his story more believable, that's a big problem. The only other thing I'll say about this informant, there are a lot of people who don't like jailhouse informants in general. There are some states that make their testimony very difficult. I'm not somebody who thinks there shouldn't be jailhouse informants, because the fact of the matter is people often do talk in jail, and they often talk to their cellmates, and they often talk to other people in prison, and a lot of really good information comes from that. The problem is when you have something like this where Joplin has every reason to lie because he's getting something out of it, and there's no way to confirm what Joplin is saying. There's no way to test the accuracy of his statements because he's essentially just saying, yeah, the guy told me he did it. And you have that sort of naked assertion by someone who has something to benefit from. That's a problem. And I think that's where a lot of these cases go wrong, is when you have these jailhouse informants who all they have to do is say, yeah, he told me he did it, and they get something for it.
Right. And, you know, like we've mentioned before, we mentioned this in the Aisha Degree episodes, jailhouse informants are pretty common, and it's also pretty common to not get anything really good out of them, good as in actual knowledge. In that case, when we were recording, there was a jailhouse informant who had written to the Shelby County newspaper saying that he knew where Aisha was buried. And when investigators went to talk to him, he actually knew nothing. So that's more common, actually, than having a jailhouse informant that I've seen testify and lie on the stand. But you can see how the problem runs the gamut. So I think jailhouse informants can be very helpful, but there's a lot of just noise you have to weed through. And in this case, this is the worst case, which is actual lying on the stand when someone's life is on the line. One of the reasons that the jury did not believe the alibi that Temujin gave was because the testimony of two eyewitnesses, Richard Krueger and Renee Gobin. Both men claimed to have seen the person who committed the murder. Krueger said he saw the shooter crouching in the bushes. Gobin said he saw the shooter driving away, and both identify Temujin as the shooter. That's pretty good, right? I mean, the jury certainly thought so. But there were problems with the identification that were only discovered decades later. We've talked to you guys about how direct evidence, this is direct evidence, someone seeing the shooting happen, has a lot of problems in and of itself. People are mistaken. People misidentify people all the time. And now throw in some funny business with identification, it's even more suspect.
And I just want to say, you know, we can't harp on this enough. We harp on this all the time. But every time you hear somebody say, well, it was just a circumstantial case, the alternative is this. This is the alternative. It's either a circumstantial case or it's this kind of evidence. And I'll let you decide which one is more reliable.
Right. And let me show you why it's problematic. The identification was made through a photo lineup, which is common, and it consisted of only five photographs. At the time of trial, Temujin's lawyer had asked to see the original photographs used in the lineup. That's usually a very typical part of discovery. The prosecutor's office, who had stated at the beginning of the prosecution that it would have an, quote, open file discovery. Open file, by the way, literally means what it sounds. Open file. You can see everything they have. They're not going to hold back anything. Responded that the original photos were lost. This was their position until 22 years later, when a former police officer and private investigator discovered the original photos. And what he found was interesting, to say the least. This is from the Michigan Supreme Court description of those original photos used in the lineup. Quote, each photo was a portrait of the subject in profile. In the uncropped originals, Freeman is holding a placard with Pleasant Ridge Police Department on it. The other individuals are holding placards bearing Port Huron Police Department. In the profile pictures, Freeman is turned to his right, while the other subjects are turned to their left. Further, horizontal stripes are shown in the background of Freeman's picture, but the other photos have a white background. The mugshots from the Port Huron are also faded. I mean, basically what we have is five pictures. Four of them all look alike. They all face one way. They have the same placard, Port Huron Police Department, and they're all faded to look about the same. One photo looks different, and that's Temujin's photo. He's facing the other way. He has a different placard, and he's a clearer picture, and there's a different background. You can't help but be drawn to the completely different picture. And our minds are very suggestive. And I think that's likely what happened in this case. And that's why photo lineups are fraught. That's why you are supposed to see all the original photos in a photo lineup, because you can imagine if I'm trying to have you identify a suspect with a beard, and I give the witness six photos. One photo has a beard, and it's not the suspect. It is the suspect. And five photos with no beards. If I remembered a beard, I'm just going to go straight to the person with the beard, whether that person is is who I think I saw or not.
Yeah, and this lineup is more subtle in the way it manipulates the viewer. The people in the images are all pretty similar looking. So you couldn't say, well, you know, it's obviously the case that this is the only guy who looks like the description. And you see lineups like that sometimes, and those are not very good lineups. But in this case, you have a much more subtle type of subconscious coercions going on. And that's why this is really an incredibly flawed lineup. Now, you may be saying to yourself, what difference does it make? This person, they're just trying to pick the right person. They're not going to care about what the placard says or the stripes or the fading or anything. And that may all be true consciously, but there is a strong subconscious signal sent to the witness that photo, the one that stands out, is the one they are supposed to pick. And once, and this is the issue here, once an eyewitness is compromised in this way, there's really no going back. From that point forward, the prior identification becomes the most relevant moment for their testimony, not the crime itself, not the initial time they saw the person. Now it's the lineup. And when they identify that person in the courtroom, they're really identifying the person they saw in the lineup, not the person they saw at the scene of the crime. And this is called mugshot commitment, and it's very well understood, and it results in the witness unconsciously focusing on maintaining consistency with the identification itself rather than what they actually saw at the scene of the crime. And it gets even worse than this. Krueger, who we talked about earlier, who also picked Timogen out of this photo lineup, he also took part in what they call a corporal lineup, so a physical lineup. And in that lineup, he picked out who he thought he saw commit the crime. And the only problem was, for the prosecution, is he did not pick Timogen. He picked the wrong guy. But that didn't stop him from testifying at trial that it was Timogen who was the man who pulled the trigger. Obviously, the defense tried to use his prior incorrect identification against him, but the guy's testifying in trial, the jury's hearing all this other evidence, ninjas and jailhouse confessions, and apparently they listened to this guy, and they listened to the other person who saw him as well. And that's the other problem, right? So you've got a situation where, yeah, he got the wrong guy in the in-person lineup, but there is this other guy. And that's really what the Michigan Supreme Court said in their decision when they did not invalidate the photo lineup. It's really hard to invalidate a photo lineup. What you have to show, and this is from the opinion, quote, when it is so impermissibly suggestive as to give rise to a substantial likelihood of misidentification. So it has to be a really bad lineup. And they recognize the problems with the lineup, but they've said essentially that even if it had these problems, it was not flawed enough to reach the threshold. And the Supreme Court also pointed to another fact that made them not invalidate the conviction based on this lineup. And that was the fact that Gobian, who was the other witness, that he in particular was adamant that Kinsu was the man he saw driving away that day. But there's a problem with his testimony as well, and it's a big one. Gobian, who is the one witness who claimed to have seen Timogen in a car, only did so after hypnosis. And there's been evidence recently that the hypnotist made suggestive remarks during the process. And this was a huge problem in this time period. During this time period, there were a lot of people who were using hypnosis. and using therapy in general to help them remember things from crimes. And it's the kind of thing that led to the satanic panic. It's the kind of thing that led to some of these daycare prosecutions that you guys know about, where all these kids said that the daycare was really like a satanic temple and people were being sacrificed in the basement and children were being eaten and all this other stuff, right? This all came from this therapy that people were using to remember things that they could not remember. And they were having ideas implanted in their heads. It wasn't as if the therapist meant for that to happen, but it was happening nonetheless. And so looking back on this, you can really see the problems with this evidence against Temujin. The photo lineup was flawed. It gave a strong subconscious signal about who to pick. And Gobian, his memory is completely unreliable because of this hypnosis. There's no way to know whether he is remembering what he saw or if he is remembering what he was told he saw.
Brett, I've never had a hypnosis in one of my cases to bring out a memory. Have you?
No, and I don't think I ever will either.
I don't think so.
I don't know if it's something that nobody uses anymore or not. I would think that it would be a rare instance when hypnosis would be allowed. And in fact, apparently the prosecutor did not know they were going to do this hypnosis on this guy. And when he found out, he was really mad because he even recognized, even at the time, that this was a problem for him. But, you know, it worked out in the end anyway.
Now, Temujin was represented by a lawyer who was addicted to drugs at the time and under investigation by the police. So he did not have the best representation, shall we say. Temujin's attorney was known to buy drugs from his clients and would end up ultimately losing his license to practice law. In fact, his counsel was found to be ineffective in several cases during this time period when Temujin was being represented by him. And he had also previously represented the chief investigator in a civil suit. That's not good, Brett.
It's not great.
That's not great.
Now, I'll say this, and I think this has been raised a lot. We talked about this before. We talked about ineffective assistance of counsel and those claims. Obviously, Temujin has raised those claims, and they've all been rejected. And I think the reason they've been rejected, this seems bad. You know, he's on drugs. He's buying drugs from his clients. He's getting disbarred soon. He's being found ineffective in other cases. He arguably has a conflict because he represented the chief investigator in this civil suit. But if you actually look at the transcript, he was a pretty zealous advocate. I mean, he objected when he should have objected. And his cross-examination was pretty good. His opening statement was pretty thorough. And his closing statement was pretty good. I don't agree with all his decisions. I think trying to attack Crystal for staying with Temujin after she was raped really blew up in his face. I think that probably the jury didn't like that. I think it actually played into the theory of the prosecution, which was that she was this naive rural country girl who would do something like that. And he's this overpowering personality that, despite the fact that their first, you know, encounter is an encounter of violence and rape, that she would stay with him anyway. That wasn't great. Didn't work. Bad decision. But the problem is the standard for ineffective assistance is really, really high. And one of the things specifically that will not get you there are strategic decisions, no matter how bad they are. If your lawyer makes a strategic decision to either pursue a particular course or not pursue it, or make a claim or not make the claim, or challenge a witness in a certain way or not, that's just not good enough. We're not going to second guess lawyers like that. And the problem was he might have been bad and he might not have been as good as he could have been, but he wasn't so bad that Temujin could win that. It's kind of weird. If you're going to lose your case, you want your lawyer to be terrible. Like, you don't want a lawyer who's okay. You want him to be just so bad. He has to be terrible. And you don't have that in this case. This is just not a case where his lawyer, you know, slept through trial. It just didn't happen.
Right. It really puts you in a rock and a hard place because you don't want a terrible lawyer, obviously, when you're being represented. But that's what you need on appeal. And to go on appeal means that you've already lost at the trial level. So it's a rock and a hard place. Now, let's back up. We've talked a lot over these two episodes, but let's just look at the evidence against Temujin. A green army jacket was found in Temujin's car, and this matched the testimony of witnesses who said the murderer was wearing a green army jacket. That's it.
That's pretty much it.
No car that traces back to him. Dozens of, not dozens, double-digit witnesses who can place him hundreds of miles away, where it would be impossible for him to have driven from the murder scene back to the martial arts studio. The only way he could have done this was by chartering a private plane that was not recorded. The flight was not recorded anywhere, and the money that he used to pay for it was not traced, or that he somehow talked a pilot into giving him a free ride so that he could get hours for flying. And the casings don't match anything that back to Temujin. That's right. It. A green army jacket that matches a jacket by the eyewitnesses that we've already pointed out may have had very faulty memories.
And Crystal testifies about this jacket as well, because, I mean, this really was the only piece of physical, quote unquote, physical evidence that tied the murders together. Now, there's nothing on this jacket. You know, it's not like there's blood on the jacket or anything. There's nothing like that. I mean, it's literally just they found a jacket and the jacket was similar. And that's basically it. Everything else is speculation, Crystal's testimony, the testimony of these eyewitnesses, which we now know are pretty flawed, the testimony of this jailhouse informant, which was always weak, but is really weak now that he's recanted on his deathbed. And I got to go back to those shotgun shells we talked about yesterday. A man's killed with a shotgun, you find a box of shotgun shells, and there's fingerprints on it, and they don't match the person you think did it. That's pretty bad. I mean, that's a glaring problem with your theory of the case. And we've basically told you everything. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, other little things, both in the trial transcript and in the record, that maybe you could point to, but this is pretty much it. And I got to ask you, Alice, I mean, now that we've gotten through with this, I mean, what do you think? Do we have a case where there's an innocent man in prison?
I think there certainly was not enough evidence to convict him. And I'd go further to say, yeah, I don't think he's the one who killed Scott Macklin. What about you?
I agree with you 100%. I think this is the kind of case that can make you mad and should make you mad. I mean, this is a man who spent, 30 years in jail, in prison, in Michigan for a crime he did not commit, where it seems pretty obvious that he didn't commit it. This is not a close one. You know, everybody who spend all this energy and effort trying to convince the world that Scott Peterson's innocent, I wish you would put your energy and effort towards a case like this with a guy who clearly, to me, isn't guilty. And it's kind of funny. There's sort of all these different, is there enough evidence to convince him or to convict him beyond a reasonable doubt? Is he not guilty? Is he innocent? You know? And we don't normally talk about innocence in the criminal justice system. You're either guilty or not guilty. You don't say innocent that much. In this case, Timmerson's innocent. He did not do this. And I hope that people are paying enough attention to this case and there's enough pressure on people like the governor of Michigan that something will happen soon to correct what is clearly an injustice.
That's right, Brett. And you know, I think this is the first time we've gone so far as to say someone is completely innocent. We've often said, you know, it doesn't reach reasonable doubt, or there is reasonable doubt, so someone shouldn't be convicted. But, I guess we said Michael Peterson too. But there we actually knew who did it. Here, I don't know who did it, because the entire focus of the prosecution, the entire focus of law enforcement was on, I think, the wrong person.
Right. No, from the very beginning, they decided he did it from the very beginning, and it did not matter what evidence they saw. It was not going to convince them that he wasn't there. And that's unfortunate, because Scott is dead and he was murdered, and we don't know who murdered him. We don't know whether it was some sort of love triangle or some relationship thing, or there's always been speculation about the drug trade and whether or not he was involved in that. But I think the one person we can say for certain did not do this is Temujin Kinsu. We mentioned this before, but reach out to Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of Michigan. She can fix this, and she should fix it. Temujin needs to be released. He does not need to be in prison. There's nothing that can give him back the 30 years that he's lost, but he doesn't need to spend one more day in prison. So we're interested to hear what you guys think about this. Shoot us an email at prosecutorspod@gmail.com. Look us up at prosecutorspod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We're on Reddit. We're on YouTube. We're all over the place. Go to our website, prosecutorspodcast.com. Any way you want to talk to us, send us a smoke signal, send us a homing pigeon, whatever. We will get back to you. We love talking to you guys. Keep leaving those 5-star reviews on Apple. Join us on Patreon, however you want to support the podcast. And one great way to do that is to support our sponsors, BetterHelp and Athena Club. Go check out their websites. Use those promo codes. And the more you help them, the more you help us. Well, Alice, do you have anything else you want to add today?
That's it for me, Brett.
Well, I can't wait to be back with you again next week when we will have a new case, new questions, and new answers. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. The dog's barking.
Problem?
I'm gonna let him stop barking.
Okay.
For a second. But no. I think that's always barking.
What is there?
Who knows? Oh. He's always barking something. So that's the good thing about it. At night he doesn't bark.
She said this group was called a Kusar. Is that how you say it?
I don't know that it exists, so.
Okay, fair enough. So she said the group.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip. trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. So find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big.